Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. This episode is part of a special mini-series produced in collaboration with Bloomberg Businessweek, bringing you sustainable finance and leadership for a changing world.
I actually think that, you know, concerted effort, a targeted program to try and get the worst cars off the road in favor of electric cars would be a really interesting public-private partnership that would be the immediate beneficiary of. So it'll be interesting to see if something like that actually, if there's a politician or a group of activists who can actually champion for something like that.
My guest today is Joel Weber, the magazine's editor, who's based in New York but joins me here today in London. Joel joined Bloomberg in 2012 as a senior editor covering banking, finance, economics, and technology, and also helped develop Bloomberg Pursuits before becoming the editor of Bloomberg Markets magazine. He has worked at publications including ESPN The Magazine, Men's Health, Best Life, and Men's Journal. Joel has helped win two national magazine awards and has been a finalist for another, and co-authored the Men's Health Big Book of Food and Nutrition. Joel, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I so enjoyed the festival that we've just had.
It was a great success, right?
Amazing what you can do with 6 weeks of planning, hard work, and inspiration.
Little duct tape, bubble gum, dental floss, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about Bloomberg Business Week. You have had a focus on good business. Why did you decide to make that particular focus?
So Bloomberg Business Week, Business Week as a magazine has actually been around for 90 years. This is our 90th year. Bloomberg actually acquired it 10 years ago. So it's been Bloomberg Business Week for 10. In that time, we've developed an amazing tradition of narrative journalism, of breaking news. And we're really good at impactful stories that often can change policy even. And one of the things that we're also known for is kind of, you know, taking it to business every once in a while and keeping them honest. And as much as we do that, and we do that weekly, we also have to recognize that there's this other side that sometimes business can actually change the world and be an agent for good. And so Good Business was a franchise that we developed to actually recognize the businesses and people that are actually changing the world for good and using business as a power that's not just raking profits out of people's pockets.
So we'll return a little bit to some of the businesses that we spoke to and encountered during our festival together over the last few days. But let me just ask you a prior question, which is about the state of the media industry as a whole. As an editor of a magazine where there's just been some very deep structural changes to the industry, and a magazine which, at least from the outside, seems to be thriving and succeeding and has a devoted audience and top-notch staff. How are you managing to thrive and succeed in what is, I think, a difficult and changing market?
No doubt. It's a difficult one, and it continues to change, and I have no doubt that it's going to continue to change. So I view what we do as part of an ecosystem, and Bloomberg is unlike any other ecosystem. So what we're doing is really adding value into a portfolio that is a completely different portfolio than anyone that I know of in publishing. And as long as we're adding value to that, I think we're doing an interesting thing. And within the last year and change, Bloomberg and Bloomberg.com have launched a paywall. And that paywall to me is actually, it really speaks to the fundamental underlying change that we see that we're on the cutting edge of, which is this transition, frankly, away from an advertising subsidized model towards a reader-driven one. And it's still in our infancy because we're less than 2 years into this experiment. And when we look around, you know, it's FT has a history of this. Wall Street Journal has a history of this. Economist has a history of this. New York Times has a history of this. And we feel that we can compete with all of them. And Business Week is a real important player in that because we can bring a different style of journalism and reporting and narrative and loyalship to what we do every week. It's not just breaking news. We're going for bigger stories that help you make sense of an ever-changing world, but not just contributing to the noise, helping you make sense of it.
Fabulous. So let's talk a little bit about...
But I do think, just in general,
yeah,
we're, as content providers, we are in a constant war for your time. And your time is the most valuable thing that you have. So whenever we give you content, we have that in mind, that it's not, your time is not something that we can take for granted. And either we have to give you news that you can use, or maybe we can tell you a story in a way that just absolutely takes your breath away.
So speaking of a war for time, we just spent a full day together on a Sunday with 12 or 13 speakers talking about good business. And we filled the room. So, you know, we competed for time, and a bunch of very interesting and influential people showed up to listen to the content that we jointly presented. So let's talk a little bit about our joint reflections on the day. I was very struck by the panel on clean air. And a couple of things that I took away from it, and I'd love your thoughts and reactions, was firstly, polluted and dirty air, not just in developing economies, China or India or places where you know that there's really massive problems with clean air, but in countries like the United Kingdom and right here in London, is a massive public health cataclysm. I think the data was 7 million people die each year, and the excess deaths as a result of both outdoor and indoor air pollution. That 40,000 people in the UK alone die, that air quality disproportionately affects poor people and people of color. But it also results in new science that's just emerged in levels of dementia and obesity. It's a big problem. And yet, citizens don't seem to fully grasp the scale and the magnitude of that public health fiasco. Why do you think that is?
So I think often public health issues can feel so huge that you don't have agency to change them. And something like air is, you basically almost take it for granted. And then, you know, I think the other thing is it's changed. You know, the air quality here in London hasn't always been this bad. And yet, because of some policy changes, especially regarding diesel, things have gotten much worse very quickly. So I think that the tide is turning. In America, we've had a history of actually having, you know, clean air acts. California has long been a champion of this. New York, actually, for being as big of a city as it is, has reasonably clean air. So to have London actually feel like you're sort of back in the dark ages, it's very troubling. And I do think that we will continue to see people galvanize around this. I know there's a colleague that I have at Bloomberg who actually had he's based in the U.S. in Seattle, had been over in London and had been stationed here in the 90s, came back with his family last year, and actually had to leave within months because the particular matter triggered asthma for him and his kid. And that asthma thing is going to be, I think, the biggest thing, because the health is immediately, your health is immediately at risk. So I think doctors are aware of it now. In the public health space, we're having multiple people speak up. And that was basically what this panel was about.
Yeah, and I was struck by the fact that I agree there is rising awareness. There will be increased public agitation and mobilization, and that will inevitably percolate through to some kind of regulation. And in London, we see the ultra-low emission zone begin to send a market signal that there is a price for dirty air.
Yeah.
And so then you begin to see how actors respond. And what I was struck by is the quickest way that you improve air quality. About a third of poor air is attributable to motor vehicles. And if you can electrify your motor vehicles and your buses and your vans, you can really lead to a accelerated improvement in air quality. And you're beginning to see with ultra-low emission zone this beginning to happen.
I actually think the anger so far has been maybe less directed at the air quality than maybe the car companies involved in Dieselgate. And so one of the things that actually came up on this panel was, you know, what's a model for a solution here? And I actually asked a question because we've had a clunker for cash program in the US before. Turns out you guys have actually had something like that here in London before. But I actually think that, you know, concerted effort, a targeted program to try and get the worst cars off the road in favor of electric cars would be a really interesting public-private partnership that would be the immediate beneficiary of. So it'll be interesting to see if something like that actually, if there's a politician or a group of activists who can actually champion for something like that.
And then, of course, we had a representative of Uber on the panel.
And a good thing we did, I think, actually, because he brought in a different perspective than everyone else did.
Completely. And Uber has, as I understand it, implemented a surcharge in which riders pay 15 cents a mile in the inner city, in the ultra-low emission zone, which then goes into a fund. Uber doesn't take its commission on that payment. And their hope is that that will generate over time about £200 million that will then help Uber drivers to finance the conversion away from combustion engine, fossil fuel driven cars to electric vehicles. And that seems to me to be kind of an interesting model. And I guess the question that that I have is that if that's such a good idea, and if Uber is in the business of mobility, but also therefore also in the business of air pollution, why is it doing it just in London and not on a global basis?
One of the things that he said on the panel, which you'll obviously hear here, is that there is a, you know, already there was a congestion tax in place, right? And so to piggyback on something that was already existing created a framework that they could easily work with. But as we challenged him during the interview, why not scale this and take it other places? And I think that's totally the right question. What's even more interesting to me is, like, what does this pot might look like when you take it elsewhere? Does it have to just be for Uber drivers? Or could you actually make the pot be something that a municipality might actually vie for to say, look, we're doing this and we're going to tax consumers and drivers, say, but we're going to have this gigantic pie. And if you are willing to change policy and help us electrify your city, all of this money is yours. That even becomes more interesting, and it's less about Uber and its drivers than it is about a city actually embracing change.
So London and the UK are poised to roll out electric vehicle charging points.
One reason I think that's really interesting,
yeah.
Imagine if business could actually change policy, right? And business has the capacity for leading the way here, since policymakers have effectively dropped the ball. So if policy can't do it, business can absolutely do it, and that's where good business comes in.
Right, and so, you know, if you can roll out this electric vehicle charging point program across the United Kingdom, if you can develop innovative financing mechanisms to allow Uber drivers, but potentially just regular drivers and consumers, to finance the transition to electric vehicles. Then there is a really interesting kind of model that emerges, and that started to be discussed in another one of the panels on the future of energy, in which your colleague John Moore from Bloomberg New Energy Finance participated, in which he discussed the emergence of a decentralized grid of, in the past, what you had was power being generated from one place in a very linear way, being sent down cables into cities. And now you're beginning to see electrification much more distributed. People have solar, people have wind, you have electric vehicles. Electric vehicles are mini battery storage places. If you have solar on your roof, you can charge your car, and during excess sun, it can charge your car, and then during the night, your car can put electricity back into the grid. And so you have this ability to develop a much more nimble, much more distributed, much more agile energy ecosystem in which solar, wind, and electric vehicles all play a part. I found that fascinating.
One of the other things that I found fascinating is how quickly this change has come. You know, I think one of the panelists said something to the effect that the switch from wood to coal took several decades. The switch from coal to gas at the turn of the century again also took decades. This is happening. The adoption that we're seeing is happening quicker than any of these other ones have happened. And yet there's still more progress. And it speaks to this closed loop system. And the person who's obviously most famous for this is Elon Musk, because between having an electric car that is very desirable, right, you're able to start displacing traditional cars. But then he's also had Solar City, which is not also now part of Tesla, where you can actually put, you know, tiles on your roof that your whole roof becomes solar, but it doesn't look like traditional solar panels. It looks much more desirable because it almost looks like a normal roofing panel. And then that's coming to your battery. Those batteries are also the same things that are displacing diesel generators on islands from Puerto Rico to Hawaii. So it creates this whole virtuous cycle that harnesses the sun, and you know, in other areas it'll be wind, but obviously we're on the brink of a huge transition that, as John and his data will show you, is happening very quickly, and that investors and everyday people are going to be benefiting from.
I must say that really did fill me with hope, the idea that this transition to renewables, that wind and solar are now competitive and in some instances cheaper than fossil fuels, that decentralized grids that are smart, that are powered by AI, that are able to, in an agile, responsive way, distribute power across neighborhoods and cities and between citizens based on the drawdown that you need at any given moment. That's filled me with optimism.
It's the dream, right? And you know, being able to support the initiatives, if you're contemplating a car, how do we get you to consider an electric vehicle instead of a gas one? And then having, you know, things like rebates and charging networks in place to actually really galvanize a movement.
So I wanted to come back to something else you mentioned, which was about Tesla and the power of a brand, right? So I've always said that you should try not to force human beings choose between ethics and desire, because they'll always choose desire. And so one of the things that you have to try and do in this moment where we desperately need a transition is make what is ethical desirable. And so Tesla has done that. Tesla has said it's not just some clunky, ugly, boxy, old, virtuous vehicle. It's cool, it's sexy, it's desirable, and therefore you can both be green, but also have a car that you're proud to kind of, you know, drive down the highway on. And you spoke on one of the panels to the CEO of Illy, the kind of venerated Italian coffee brand. And, you know, everything that's Italian about branding and fashion and desire and romance and coffee and espresso has this sort of allure to it. And he certainly spoke to the power of Illy as a brand. But what he said also, somewhat more surprisingly, is about their efforts to reinvent themselves as an ethical and sustainable company. Tell us more about that.
I don't even know if it's reinvent so much as it's always been there for them. The company dates to 1933. It was founded by his grandfather. He had inherited the business from his father. He's a chemist by training, which I actually thought was one of the most interesting things about him, because he doesn't approach business maybe through a traditional business architecture. He does it through a science one. So what he, I think, has really done with that company is embraced quality, is one of the things he will say. And when you use quality, you have to do everything you can to maintain that quality. And that actually makes you treat your workers and growers in a different way maybe than a traditional stakeholder model. He calls it a shareholder model, which puts himself at the bottom and your customers at the top and your growers in the middle. Your employees are in there as well, but he's actually the bottom. And when you think about that from a, it's not a top-down mechanism that I think current capitalism is sort of in everyone's ire over. It actually feels like there is a different model out there that can still get profit. You can still be profitable, but maybe there's a bigger cause here. One of the ways that I think he's manifesting itself, I found this to be really interesting and slightly different from everything else we heard throughout the day, was this attention to soil quality that I think is going to continue to distinguish that brand going forward. This, you know, our soil, it can be this big carbon sink where we can take all this carbon out of the air and get it into the ground. It actually ends up improving the quality of the soil, which in for his business improves the quality of the coffee, which improves the quality of your health when you get to enjoy it. So he sees that virtuous agriculture being a thing that Illy is really going to embrace in the years ahead.
I was very struck by his comment that if Elon Musk and Tesla perfectly succeed, then you will have cars that arguably won't emit if the electricity is driven from sustainable supplies. But if we succeed, we will draw down. If we multiply our sources of coffee, if we engage in biodynamic and more progressive forms of agriculture where we're not putting either pesticides or nitrates into the soil, and we are then producing more productive plants that then sequester carbon in the soil and make the soil more productive, we can be not just not part of the problem, but, you know, actively part of the solution.
And, you know, every decision that you make around food can help reinforce these things. So there's actually a movie that I told you about afterwards that I recommend everyone watch called The Biggest Little Farm. And they basically, the documentary is about this couple of farmers who basically buy this broken down farm and spend 7 years actually bringing it back and making it a haven for biodiversity. And that business model allowed them to actually have a huge, enormous variety of fruits and eggs that they could bring to market, which distinguishes them at the farmer's market. And now it's basically a California tourist attraction, the farm is, because of the advances that they've had. So being able to actually find farmers who practice like this, it's become a thing. Like Michael Pollan has been writing about this for going on 15 years now. And yet we have so much farther to go. And this is a space that, again, consumers and your dollars can actually impact change with, and as in supporting a coffee brand like Illy.
I was very struck. You asked him a question about the role and responsibility of CEOs in maximizing value and addressing shareholder value. And he gave what I thought was a very geeky but very compelling answer. He basically said, if you're trying to calculate net present value, it is dependent on the value of future cash flows. And future cash flows will almost certainly diminish if your brand behaves irresponsibly, is seen to plunder the planet, doesn't take into account the externalities of pollution and climate change, and isn't attentive to those questions. So when you're trying to maximize shareholder returns, if you think about net present value, you have to think about sustainability, and it is an intrinsic part of both the responsibility of management and owners, but also a way that we should be reconceiving of capitalism as a forward-looking and more progressive endeavor.
It almost felt like he was speaking to Volkswagen directly, right?
Exactly. But it is amazing to think how what used to be a fetish, which is all you're about is maximizing profit. It doesn't take a lot of mental agility, and it certainly doesn't take a course in high finance, and it certainly shouldn't have to take a course in ethics to say that actually these things are not just in tension with each other and can be reconciled. They are intrinsically interrelated, doing good and doing well.
It also is convenient when your business happens to be private and family held, 100% family held, 86 years. You can have a longer time horizon when you have a private structure like that than if you answer to shareholders perhaps every quarter in a public setting. And, you know, he said something to the effect that actually, you know, there's an organization for companies that have been around 200 years. And I kind of joked with him, like, you know, he's got a little ways to go yet. But it does speak to if you have a completely different time horizon and that you intend to pass the company along to your family members, maybe that creates a governance structure that is vastly superior to anything that we can have in a public setting.
And perhaps what it does also is tell us a little bit about the politics of time and the politics of financial reporting, right? That the central challenge that we have is if you think in days or months or quarters, then you discount the future and you don't let people take the wise, responsible, good ancestor, good custodian decisions that we require and expect of business. And so there's got to be a pushback, I think, on behalf of us as shareholders, of citizens, as regulators, to begin to say that the tyranny of quarterly profits are going to not just put us at risk as a planet and a civilization, but also going to erode the building of truly sustainable, fit for purpose and built to last businesses.
I actually think if you talk to most CEOs, they'll say the same thing, that they're driven wild by, you know, have these quarterly things because it interrupts their ability to have strategic visions. So I think long-termism is another word for this, and short-termism has been something that's been under fire for a while, especially in the States. But it does need to change from a policy standpoint. I know I have colleagues at Bloomberg News who do quarterly earning calls all the time, and I'm sure that they would happily welcome those early mornings back. So,
Joel Weber, it's been a total pleasure working with you and your team. It's been fantastic to work in partnership with Bloomberg Business Week. We will continue to showcase the most interesting pioneers working at the cutting edge of social change, and I hope you will use your megaphone to amplify them, and I hope to work with you more in the future.
We look forward to that, and congratulations to both you and The Conduit on your one-year anniversary.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations, produced in partnership with Bloomberg Business Week. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. For more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com. To learn more about Bloomberg Business Week, please visit businessweek.com. And thank you.